The much-debated Forsyth Park Master Plan has been updated, and much like it did in the spring, the document is generating plenty of conversation. Meb Ryan, with the Friends of Forsyth and the Trustees Garden Club, joins today's Commute Podcast to talk about the Master Plan and Forsyth's future. The Commute is presented by National Office Systems. Happy middle of the week, everyone, and thanks for listening to The Commute, Savannian's favorite podcast, at least when it comes to local newsmakers. I'm your host, Adam Van Brimmer, and I'm here in your podcast app every Tuesday and Thursday. Today's edition features conversations with Forsyth Park master planner Meb Ryan and the Savannah Jazz Festival's Teddy Adams. The Jazz Fest opens Friday and stretches through Sunday, and Adams is one of the event's founders and has been part of it for 40 showings now. That tease for the Jazz Festival done, the front half of today's program is all about Forsyth Park. And we'll get to Meb Ryan right after I introduce you to our sponsor, National Office Systems. If you are a regular listener to The Commute, you know about Scott Center and his team over at National Office Systems and how they are Savannah's experts in office design and outfitting. They work with top quality suppliers such as Dirt Modular Interiors and Herman Miller Office Furniture to create comfortable and productive workspaces. Learn more by visiting www.natoffsys.com. That's NATOFFSYS.com. Now, here's the Friends of Forsyth's Meb Ryan. Pleased to have on the commute today Meb Ryan, who is with the Friends of Forsyth and the Trustees Garden Club. Of course, Meb was with us a couple of months back when the Friends of Forsyth first had rolled out some conceptual plans for some Forsyth Park changes. And if people are following the story, know that it was met with, at least amongst some very loud people, some pushback. But the Friends of Forsyth took a lot of the feedback that they got in the spring and some of the reactions to those plans and were able then to refine into a new plan, which I think, Meb, was probably the intention all along. It wasn't like we rolled out those conceptual plans. It's like, okay, we're going with one of these two. You're really stuck with it. That wasn't the case. That might have been how it was portrayed in some quarters, but that wasn't the case. When you look at the new updated plan, which rolled out, I think about a week ago, what is significantly different about it and how has the response been?
Well, thank you so much for inviting us here today. We're excited to share more. And as you said, yes, the conceptual designs were presented in April, and it was our intention all along to gather feedback on those and then come back to the community this fall with a revised draft plan. And so I think what the community is seeing and reacting to is really a compilation of what we heard with regard to things that the community does not want the team to pursue, the things that they want to see maintained, and the things they want to see enhanced in the park. And so what we have now is really a response, and not just to the loudest voices we heard, but to all the voices we heard. We received, again, over 2,500 responses during our community engagement in April. And all of those have been sifted through and analyzed to get us where we are today, which I think is a really appealing plan or vision that doesn't make substantive design changes in the park, but does allow for the park's, you know, uses to continue, but also to be enhanced. And even in some instances, you know, new uses added per, you know, the feedback from the community.
I know that the key term that was pulled out from the plan that was used in the headline of the story was to keep the historical integrity of the park. Can you talk to that specifically? What maybe changed or how you tweaked it to protect that historical integrity? Because I think that was pretty much the undercurrent from the people that were pushing back. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a great point. Well, all along, historic integrity has been really important to this plan. And by that, we mean, you know, the tree canopy, the keeping the historic integrity intact, especially in the northernmost portion of the park, which dates to 1841 and is largely intact from late 19th century, you know, the circulation patterns and vegetation, et cetera.
You're talking about the fountain at the park.
park north.
Yes, yes, yes. That end of the park from a roughly Hall or so north to Gaston. Mm-hmm. Yes. But historic integrity, I think, you know, to the community also means maintaining the open field space, the current patterns of circulation with the central LA remaining, you know, as it has, not installing, new circulation paths such as were proposed in like conceptual option 2, which showed an arcing path connecting the east and west sides of the park. But another thing that I'd like to speak to with regard to historic integrity is the central area of the park. We call it the threshold, but it's that area between the two dummy forts where the rotary, where the two playgrounds are located currently. That area is a very historic area of the park and traditionally, historically, was used for passive uses. It was not a place for, active intense uses or large crowds, et cetera. But of course, that's the way it's evolved over time. And people love that about that part of the park. But what we see now in this new draft plan that we brought out is sort of a compromise with restoring part of that area to its more passive use, but then also retaining Rotary Club playgrounds in that area to accommodate, you know, families with children who, you know, historically have loved to gather in that area. We have a really experienced historic preservation firm, Ethos Preservation, working with us. And so, you know, preservation of this park has been top of mind the whole time.
You talk about the Rotary Park. Is that the one for the smaller kids or is that the one for the little bit bigger kids?
Yes. No, the Rotary Club playground is the one that's closest to the Eastern Dummy Fort where the cafe is located.
Right. Okay.
And yeah, it is primarily focused on younger children, but also for differently abled children, which is one of the beautiful things about that playground.
Yeah, I think it's in the tradition of Savannah saying new mall, old mall.
Right.
That's the new playground, not the old playground. Right. So where does the old playground go?
So the older playground, which is nearing its end of life, is proposed to be moved to the southern end of the park. Previous conceptual designs recommended that all of the active uses in the park be clustered at the southern end. But there was a lot of feedback about that, that the community did not want to see that happen. And so the design team went back, and what we're proposing now is spreading out those children's activities throughout the park. So the idea is that the playground, the older playground that's near the end of life, would be removed and then a new playground built on the southern end of the park to include water play.
Okay.
And non-skid surfaces. It would be a playground accessible for differently abled children, but also for all ages of children. And it's proposed to be located near a new gathering picnic type space and where the new restrooms would be. So it would make it a real family-friendly destination. And moving that activity to the southern end of the park also allows us to create a more passive gathering space with tables and chairs or picnic tables in the location where the old playground is now, because that is something the community was very clear about. They wanted to have areas in the park where you could have a picnic, you know, sit and talk with your friends. And right now those places really don't exist. There are a lot of benches, you know, on the linear benches, but there's not a lot of places where you could gather and
do that. The cafe has some tables, but beyond that, yeah, you're absolutely right.
But if you wanted to bring your own picnic, you're limited.
Right. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned active uses south end of the park. Right now, you have tennis at that end of the court. At that end of the park, you also have basketball. Are those staying, moving, expanding?
Yes, they are staying, tennis courts staying in the current location. The basketball courts are proposed just to be shifted slightly to the west to accommodate closer to Whitaker Street, to accommodate that new playground area, which will be installed to the east of the basketball courts.
The feedback, the initial feedback I've heard, and of course here I usually hear the negative feedback long before I hear the positive feedback, was obviously you've talked about widening the path that encircles the park, the walking and biking and running path. Why widen those? And what do you think that adds to the park?
Well, that's a great question. One of the things that we heard that was at the top of the things that the community wants to see happen is sort of a separation of bicyclists from pedestrians due to, you know, safety issues, the bikes whizzing past you, et cetera. So, initially the conceptual designs back in April proposed a separate pedestrian path further on the interior of the park, which started to encroach on the open space. And we heard loud and clear that the community does not want to see that happen. You can certainly understand that. So when the design team was here in June for several days, we spent many hours in the park with a team of arborists investigating the current perimeter sidewalk to see, is it possible to widen that sidewalk to create a space, a lane for faster moving traffic and a lane for slower moving pedestrian traffic. And they examined every tree along the park and everything that would be in the path of the proposed path. And they have determined that, yes, I mean, it would not be easy, but it can be done. And we feel that's a great compromise to separating these two uses, but also not encroaching on the interior of the park.
So what's the process from here? I know that the comments are open, I believe, through the end of the month, with the whole intention of then kind of taking that, making any refinements are necessary, and then at least having a workshop with the city, because that's the end goal, is with the city. You know, walk us through the process.
Mm-hmm. Right. So from here, we have our comment period is open through September 30th. So we encourage everyone to go to friendsofforsyth.org and look at the draft plans. There are videos of the two virtual meetings that we had. If you look in the frequently asked questions, you can pull those up to actually hear the planning team present the plan and explain some of the nuances of it. But yes, we are open for comment until September 30th. We are going to be back out in the park this Saturday from 10 to 2 in two locations, one north of the fountain and the other near the playground area, where we'll have the plan posted, where we can answer questions and you can fill out a comment form there. But we really are eager. What's been great is we're getting a lot of positive feedback. But as you mentioned earlier, a lot of the more vocal feedback tends to be negative. And when people are supportive, they don't oftentimes feel like they need to comment. But we want to hear everybody's feedback. That's what's going to make this, a really impactful long-term vision for the park. So once we have all those comments, then the team will go back and analyze all the data as we've done during the past two community engagement periods and make further refinements to the plan. Also, what's coming up and what the team is working on now is drafting detailed guidelines for furnishings like benches, and fixtures like water fountains, lighting designs, pavement recommendations. All those things will be part of the plan and they're being worked on now. So after refinements are made and the draft plan is sent to the cost estimators, and we have all that information, the final plan, and it's going to be a very thick document, will be presented to the city and then would go on to city council for adoption through their regular process.
Okay. With that, because I know that I hate to go back and retrace history, but I'm going to a little bit. What was your task challenge agreement with the city initially? Because I think people are probably sitting there saying, well, why are Friends of Forsyth doing this with the city? Can you give us a little bit of that background?
Sure, of course. So this is a long-term legacy project for Trustees Garden Club, and we started meeting with city officials back in 2016. So it's been three administrations that we've worked with. Mm-hmm. In 2019, we signed a memorandum of understanding with the city that outlined our roles in this process of completing the master plan. And so our responsibility was to hire the planning firm, manage the process, pay for the process, and work alongside city staff to ensure that all of their input and expertise was used in the creation of the plan. And then on the city side, that they would agree to review it and in good faith adopt it at the end of the process. So that's how the agreement reads. And I'm sure it's available through the Open Records Act or, you know, Clerk of Counsel if anybody's interested. So that puts us where we are now.
Okay, great. And I don't want to get too far ahead of the process, but we touched on this the last time we talked. So the whole idea is once this gets passed, adopted, whatever gets passed or adopted, that Friends of Forsyth, very much like Piedmont Park Conservancy and some others, will then become, it becomes a little bit of a private partner, private-public partnership. It remains a public asset. I want to make sure everybody understands that. It remains a public asset. But the entity, Friends of Forsyth, then is going to have the ability to raise funds and invest back in the park. Is that a good way of kind of saying where this is eventually going?
I think, yeah, that's great. That's a great way of saying it. And I'm glad you brought that up, because what's come up, some of the questions that we've received are, you know, how's the city going to pay for this? And this is all taxpayer money, and it's not right to put all of this on the taxpayers, which, you know, we agree. We know the city has lots of priorities, obviously. And so this is not meant to be, you know, one big capital improvement project funded by the city of Savannah and the taxpayers. So I just want to really make that clear. The plan is a vision for, even if there wasn't any private investment, it's really a vision for if and when the city has monies available, you know, to improve the park or to, you know, enhance the maintenance, et cetera, that this is the direction that they would go in. For example, the city already has money budgeted for lighting improvements in the park, but they've been waiting for the master plan to actually implement those. That's already money budgeted. So that's not above and beyond as a result of this master plan. But obviously, there are going to be projects, you know, like gathering spaces, the new playgrounds that are going to be expensive. And some of them may be things the city would have funded down the road or maybe not. So, yes, our goal would be to see a nonprofit organization set up to fundraise and also to provide volunteerism in the park through, you know, educational guides or what have you, weed pulling days, to support the park. We, you know, I think if people, you know, step back and think about it, there's a history of, you know, private organizations being involved in the, you know, in the park. And for example, Trustees Garden Club, of course, you know, we redid the Fragrant Garden and we continually work in the Fragrant Garden once a month with city staff. Our goal is to actually give that garden a facelift. It's in need of it. The garden needs to be made ADA accessible. So, you know, we've also contributed to the installation of the brick sidewalks and the landscaping between the two playgrounds. The Rotary Club Savannah has donated that amazing playground next to the cafe, and they maintain it, and it's their intention to maintain it in perpetuity. So, you know, civic spaces, most civic spaces in our city and in other cities benefit from a public-private partnership, and Forsyth Park has not been the exception to the rule, and it won't be going forward.
Well, that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, that exhausts all my questions. So thank you for taking the time to talk with me today and get the information out there. And obviously, folks, if you want to come and learn more about it, but not only can you go to our site and the Friends of Forsyth site, but also you can come out 10 to 2 on Saturday to Forsyth and talk to them in person, take a look at their plan. But Matt, it is good to catch up with you again. And thanks for the time.
Thank you so much for having us. We really appreciate it.
We'll move on to talking about the Savannah Jazz Festival in a moment, right after I plug the best source for local news in Savannah. That's right, the Savannah Morning News and SavannahNow.com. What's the latest on the Forsyth Park Master Plan? Well, you just heard about it, but you can read about it too at SavannahNow.com. What about the latest impact of COVID-19 on our local schools? Again, SavannahNow.com. What's going on with Georgia Southern football? You get the picture, SavannahNow.com. You can get full access to our digital content for just $1 a month for the next 6 months. Go to SavannahNow.com/subscribe now and sign up. We will spend the balance of today's podcast talking about the Savannah Jazz Festival. The event is this weekend, and we were blessed to have acclaimed vocalist Stephanie Nicosian on Tuesday's episode. Today, I'm joined by Teddy Adams, the Savannah native who is a wizard with the trombone. He also helped start the jazz festival, and he tells us all about the history in this interview. excited to be joined on today's commute by Teddy Adams with the Savannah Jazz Festival. I was fortunate to be joined earlier this week by Stephanie Nicasia, who is going to do some jazz vocals with the Jazz Festival on Saturday night. And of course, Teddy is going to play this weekend as well. But I thought we'd take this opportunity to talk to Teddy a little bit about the history of the festival. Of course, if you read a newspaper, you saw a Sunday front page story a week or so ago that kind of really talked about the history. And Teddy was very much a focus of that story by Laura Nwogu. And I thought it did a really good job of laying out the history. So Teddy, can you kind of take us back? I know that this all started with you and Ben Tucker, right?
That's right. 1983 was the year for the first festival. I think the first two or three festivals were just one-day festivals, and they were contained at Grayson Stadium.
And when did it start to kind of blow up and gain a popularity? When did the city come on? Was the city on board from the beginning?
The city was on board, but after they realized the potential of the festival, then the funds were increased and we got more support. So as it grew, the support grew. And after about maybe 6 or 7 years, it turned into a week-long festival.
Right.
So that's quite growth from one day to a week in multiple locations.
Yeah. Yeah, now it is a highlight of the annual schedule, usually played down at Forsyth Park because of COVID in a venue at Savannah Station. And as I said the other day when I was talking to Stephanie, people don't just all show up at Savannah Station Thursday through Saturday. It's a limited capacity, but you are more than welcome to watch on the live stream through the SavannahJazzFestival.org website. Teddy, you've had the privilege of playing with some of the jazz greats over the years here at the Savannah Jazz Festival. What are some of the ones that really stand out in your mind?
Well, you know, the Savannah Jazz Orchestra, which I co-lead along with Randall Reese, mm-hmm. and we have been in existence for maybe 25, 30 years. We have brought in a who's who among artists to perform with the festival. I mean, we've had some of the biggest names out there. We've had Benny Golson. We've had Clark Terry. We've had the late Kevin Mahogany. We've had Diane Shore, Jimmy Heath. The list just goes on and on. John Faddis. We have really been fortunate to bring in the biggest names out there. The only prerequisite is that they have music for a big band. So if they do that, then they're welcomed.
And your specialty, of course, is the trombone. How do the horns work into the whole the jazz genre?
Well, you know, each horn can either be a supporting instrument or a solo instrument. You know, for a long time, the trombone was not really viewed as a major solo instrument. You know, like the saxophone, the trumpet, the piano, the guitar. But now, almost any instrument, if it can be played well, can be featured as a soloing instrument. So we've brought in some great trombone players here also. We've had, about 3 years ago, we had two of the best trombone players in jazz featured with the Savannah Jazz Orchestra. We featured Wycliffe Gordon and Ron Wilkins, two great trombone players, you know. So we include all instruments and vocalist.
And Laura's story from a couple of days ago, you talked about growing up in Savannah and how in the 50s, there was a day when Savannah really was a jazz mecca. Did you see it kind of ebb a little bit and then with the jazz festival kind of build back up? And where is it now in terms of what is Savannah's place in the jazz world now?
Well, prior to about 1960, because of location and because of I-95 had not been completed.
Right.
Rather than bypass it, people had to come through Savannah if they were going from the southeast to the northeast or vice versa. Therefore, yeah. Savannah being a seaport town, a lot of guys stopped here, a lot of musicians, a lot of entertainers. They weren't even booked. Savannah is a pretty good town. We've heard things about it. So we'll take a chance on getting a job there. And around 1960, it started to wane somewhat. And that's one of the reasons that I left Savannah, because the Savannah that I vividly remember and grew up in when I was learning to play no longer existed. And I was away for 16, 17 years. And after meeting Ben Tucker in Tokyo in 1967, not even realizing that we would ever encounter each other again back here, I returned and he owned a radio station. So he said, "I'm retired. I don't play anymore. I'm a businessman." And when I explained the legacy and the heritage of Savannah and some of the musicians that it has produced, then he said, "Okay, well, maybe I'll pick my bass back up." It was in storage in New York.
Thank God for that.
Yeah, the latter part of the 70s, he sent for Bertha, that's his name for the bass, and we started a group called the Telfair Jazz Society. And that was really beginning of the resurgence of the music. The Coastal Jazz Association, which is now Savannah Jazz, came about because Ben and I taught a jazz class at Savannah State. And the members of that class said, "Well, let's get together and listen to music and discuss it and have fun." As a result of that, the festival started exactly 1 year after that class. The class was taught in 1982. The festival started in 1983. And we were fortunate enough with the first festival to get an all-star group of about 10 or 12 people that were in Atlanta. We got a package deal, very, very reasonable. And since then, and greatly because of Coastal Jazz or Savannah Jazz, we have kind of brought the attention, the focus, the awareness, and the interest in jazz again. You know, that's a good thing.
40 festivals. So you said 1983, but this is the 40th one, and that's because you had two in 1 year, right? Correct.
Right. The year of that Atlanta hosted the Olympics. The regatta event was held here because Atlanta has no water.
Right.
And because of that, we did an additional festival, and that's the year we featured Ray Charles. He was the headliner. So that year we did two festivals, and we haven't missed a year thus far. Last year we thought maybe it wasn't going to happen, but thanks to WACV and the city and the screening process, we were able to do it, and we're repeating it again this year.
Yeah. Well, if there was ever a reason to do two festivals, having Ray Charles on the bill was certainly a pretty good reason to do it. So talk about last year. You did it live streamed. You did it with even a smaller audience than you're having this year. I think this year you're having like 125. Last year you had 50. What is it? People will say, "Well, you know, that's a bit of a letdown." But at the same time, it's probably a lot more intimate too. Is there something to be said for the intimacy of this kind of setup?
It's more intimate, but it's nothing like having a live audience. Mm-hmm. You know, a live audience responding to the music and to the musicians inspires both the music and the musicians. So the positive part about streaming is, although the presence of an audience is limited, the viewing capacity is much greater. You know, over a 3-day period in Forsyth Park, we may get 25,000-30,000 people. But I think that the first day last year, we reached about 75,000 or 80,000 people the very first day. Okay. So at least as far as exposure, it's advantageous to us doing it by streaming it. But as far as the actual feeling and the experience, it's nothing like playing to a live audience.
So as I mentioned, I talked to Stephanie, and she's one of the divas to play with the jazz orchestra. I know this isn't the first time you've done that. What is it like to have a big band playing with some really talented vocalists?
Well, we went after some headliners, and we weren't able to work that out. With this pandemic going on, sometimes it's kind of difficult to work and negotiate. So we came up with the concept, well, if we don't get a national or international headliner, we have great singers in the immediate area. Mm-hmm. So why not choose 3 or 4 of the better singers and present them to the public? Yeah. And they have contrasting styles. all three are professional singers. They're great singers, but they have their own style. So that's going to be interesting for the audience to hear, to witness.
So with the festival being in a smaller venue again, it lives on. How eager are you for us to get past the pandemic and to return to Forsyth Park? What's it going to be like, whether it's next year? God hopes it's next year. What do you anticipate that return to be like?
That's going to be great. And I anticipate that return to be monumental. When you have not done something for 2 or 3 years and it returns or you resume it, then people are hungry for it. You know, so like Forsyth Park, I expect that to be jam-packed all three nights. And we do other venues throughout the week anyway, because people have not been able to actually experience that in person. I'm sure they're chomping at the bits to do that. So we're looking forward to the ceasing of this pandemic and the resuming of the festival in real time.
Well, it is Thursday through Saturday, I believe.
Friday through Sunday.
Friday through Sunday. Very right. Good.
Normally, it's all week long, with the park nights being Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Thursday being blues night, gospel night, and Friday and Saturday, we bring in the heavy hitters, the national acts. And sometimes we would have a Sunday brunch. So occasionally, we would have a Sunday event. This year, it's just Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, but it has changed because the finale act is going to be held on Sunday night. We're bringing in Grammy Award-winning Ranky Tanky from our sister city, Charleston, South Carolina. They're a pretty hot item right now.
Well, if folks are listening, want to learn more, savannahjazz.org is the website, and you can find out where you can find the live stream and all of the information on the times and the acts and the bands. And Teddy, it was a real pleasure talking to you. We wish you all the best this weekend.
A pleasure talking to you, and we hope for the best also.
Thanks again to Teddy Adams, and be sure to download Tuesday's Commute to hear from Stephanie Nikosian, also about the Jazz Festival. You'll find that episode and hundreds more in our archives by searching The Commute with That Savannah Opinion. So that's all for today's podcast. Thanks for listening, and stay safe out there.